The following podcast is a part of RadioMisfits.com.
Welcome to Misfits Making It. We're oddballs and we're doing cool stuff. I'm your host, Lauren LaJudice. This is the podcast version of the comedy shows I host around New York City and the road, the Misfit Variety Show, and all the shows at the Capiche Club Misfit Comedy Space down in Little Italy. So how's it going? What's up in your Misfit world? I've been preparing for the Standing Tall Together tour. Yes, we're bringing the Misfit Variety Show out on the road. We're going to Boston on March 5th and then swing into Battle Creek, Michigan on March 7th. Grand Rapids, part of Gilda's Laugh Fest. Very proud to be part of that festival, March 11th. And Chicago on Friday, March 13th at the Annoyance Theater. And then coming back east, we got Philly on New York on April 16th at the Come On Everybody in Brooklyn. And then we got Studio 34 in Philly on Friday, April 17th. Oh, and I can't forget Orlando on April 2nd. What? Yes, I know. Orlando, Florida. How'd that happen? Well, okay. So I do come down to Florida. I'm here right now, actually, every winter for comedy. I do a bunch of shows. It's a good time. I'm telling you this because I want to tell you I've noticed a difference. It was like my first night here. I did a joke that was like on the edge. And you know, there's a lot of Trumpers down here. As we know, this is the way it swings, right? But as we know, there's a lot of people, immigrants down here, and they're deeply affected by what's happening. So I did a joke that was on the line and maybe was going to see what was going to happen. And I let it sing. And you know what? The audience was with me. They were with me. It's very different vibes. And I told someone, I was like, wow, like, you know, like, and people aren't so like pro MAGA anymore. And she's like, oh no, like things have changed. Now, I'm not, and this is very much like the East Coast of Florida, Southeast Coast. I know things are different everywhere, but I just, in this little microcosm in which I visit in the winters, there has been a shift. And I think it can be a shift. This is like where we are is like where I told this joke was like 10 minutes from his Mar-a-Lago, his headquarters. So if that's happening there, like, I just do think there's hope. I do think there's hope. Talking to people, you know, just everyone feels so disheartened. And I feel you on this. I want to say, though, from the road, and I will tell you more when I'm on the road in March and April, I will give you dispatches about how it's going. On the road, I'm telling you, like, there is a shift. You're not alone. You're not alone. You're not alone. And that's what we do at the Misfit Variety Show. We bring people together to say, you're not alone. You're not alone, and being like, something is up. And is the Misfit Variety Show like a partisan production? No, it's not. But I think we are pro being open and available to difference, and saying that's okay. And you know what? Fascists can't be part of it. We can't have you. I'm sorry, I love you. If you're a little fash, if you're on the fence fash, you want to come to the show, we'll get you over to us. We'll bring you over to this land of being welcoming and positive and joyful, okay? We bring the joy, okay? But it just can't, the thing is authoritarianism and being celebrating, a celebration of uniqueness doesn't go together. It doesn't fit. So while we are anti-fascist, we're an anti-fascist show by the very nature. You cannot be absurd without being anti-fascist. It just can't happen. I'm thinking about this, especially one of my clown teachers, Philippe Gallier, just passed, and he was an anti-fascist. And he We talk about the eyes of a fascist. You come on stage with the eyes of the fascist because it's someone who wants to shove their stupid ideas down your throat instead of giving you joy. And I think we know how that's going right now. So have hope, have joy, come together in community. Join us at the Misfit Variety Show if you can. Come through Comment Thread. Welcome in my Comment Threads. Tribe of Other Misfits, I keep it a pretty positive vibe space, but I just delete the trolls. I don't got time. I just delete the trolls where I can. All right. Now, before we go into this really fun interview, which also is about like creating community, we'll talk about that in a second. Reminder, please rate and review the podcast because social proof is super important for misfits because misfits trust other misfits to know what's good. You can also sign up for updates. I send them out about once a month at laurenlogie.com. You know, you can also sponsor a podcast. We make it accessible for individuals and small businesses. So listen, we put this out about every 3 weeks. We'll put it out more often if we get a sponsor. So go to laurenlogie.com, click on listen and podcast and contact us there. Today, we're going to talk to Drew Langer. He is the first assistant director on many projects you know and love, including Somebody Somewhere, Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, and also The Baltimoreans, which just came out last fall. He's also involved with a ton of projects with the Duplass brothers. And it's a misfit producing outfit. Yes, he is a champion of the misfit voice, the misfit work, the misfit media, and you're going to love him. We talk a lot about how to create a positive vibe space and how he makes the magic happen as a first assistant director. So let's get to the interview with Drew Langer. Thank you, Drew Langer, for joining us on Misfits Making It.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been involved with like so many fun projects, misfit projects, which is how I found you. Tell us about how you got started.
I got started in music, and that was going to be, and then movies, you know, like the classic home movies, you know, get your friends in it, you know, made those. And as I got into music, I was self-taught. So I came like really late. And so then I'm like, okay, I'm going to pursue this on a university level. This is awesome. And it was really rigorous. And I had a little stage fright, which I can talk to any room, but for some reason playing the piano, like I would like get sweaty palms, you know, the whole thing. And so quickly, you know, I had worked so hard to get into this school, and quickly I'm like, I'm miserable. And this is not what I want to do at all. And so in that panic, I had been writing scripts and just for like myself, just, you know, like fan fiction and, you know, stuff like that. You just write your own little thing. And, I'm like, you know, that kind of comes naturally, you know, and I don't have stage fright with it. And I have complete control over this, whatever world I want to create. And so I wanted to do film scoring anyway. So I just sort of jumped over and was able to sort of jump into production and get that way, kind of get in that way. So that's great.
And then to film scoring is the final destination for you?
No, but that was sort of the bridge to get me, I think, into film. Like I love it, but making it the project is way more fun.
Yeah, because you're involved in the day to day. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. So how did you then move from film scoring, or you got in production and you kind of just stayed there? You loved it so much.
Right. So I jumped into, you know, the great thing about film is it's very collaborative and very democratic. So basically everyone starts at the bottom. Even if you have an in, even if you have tons of film school or doctorate. So, you know, you just start on set and then instantly, you know, I want to be on this set or I don't want to be on a set. You know, like day one, I think you either love it despite the hours and despite the work, or you're like, not for me. Like there's lots of other ways to express myself. And so I loved it. And then on the course of working, you just sort of start to specialize and then you're like, oh, I love art department or I love, you know, ADing. Which I do a lot. Or I like to be in the office and producing and kind of making sure everything's ready for the next day. So you find that very quickly. So I was able to do that. I actually started in reality TV.
Oh, wow.
Which I loathed.
Like most people who produce reality TV feel the same.
Yeah. And part of it was I put together a segment And, you know, I show it to the people and I, you know, made it cool and fun and great. And, you know, and he's like, you know what? The block between commercials is like 3:45 and yours is 3:25. So we just got to fill the block between commercials. And he said it just like technically, logistically. But for me, I'm like, oh, I'm literally just filling a block between commercials. Like no one's going to watch this after it airs. No one revisits this. Right. It wasn't a great show to begin with. And I was like, okay, I'm trapped because now I'm 2 years, 3 years committed to this and the money's good, but you know, what do I do? And so jumping into film, I'd started at the bottom again, cause it's kind of a different world, even though it's the same equipment and everything and different contacts. But then you just do the same thing. Someone finds you and you're like, you're my person. Let's work together. And you stay.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a thing I've found, is that usually like, weird people find weird people to work with and then work with them forever and ever. So I guess for people who are like, well, first of all, do you have any tips on like finding that creative tribe? Because that is a thing that I hear from a lot of people. Like, I don't have my tribe.
I think doing projects, you know, like it's easy to say, oh, do cool projects. And then, you know, you'll find them because other cool people are there. But I do think, you know, what I tell people that I work with is really every job you do is an audition for your next job. Yeah. So not only are you kicking butt, but you're making sure you're making this contact and you're doing that. And on a set, especially, is so great because everybody needs help and everybody needs, you know, that you tend to find people. And the case in point is I did this awful hell horror movie. Mm-hmm. In the middle of nowhere in Washington. And, but the people who did it, the director, the producers are great. And there was a, production manager who sort of runs the budget and books all the equipment and all that sort of stuff. And so while I run the set. And so we hit it off instantly. We in the initial prep, we wanted to blow off steam. So we all went to karaoke, at which point she sang Pat Benatar in this like cowboy bar, all old cowboys, and did a high kick, which launched her shoe in the air.
Amazing.
And landed somewhere. No one knew. Cowboys all on their feet. They went crazy. And I'm like, okay, this is clearly a tribe. This is someone I want to work with on everything. And so literally I was like, whatever you do next, I want to be a part because it's just, you know, the taste, you know, like she always had the best music and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And she's like, well, I work a lot with the Duplass brothers and I'm doing a no budget thing in LA. Would you ever move to LA? And then, you know, maybe I can plug you into these clearly no budget things. And so she was Mel Estlin, who's now the president of Duplass, who's a great filmmaker herself now. So basically I'm like, yeah, I'll move to LA and I'll work with you. Let's do it. So it was really that simple that taking this awful job that, you know, I'm like, I've made a huge mistake. We shot in this underground nuclear silo that's been abandoned. And every day it was 5 stories down that you had to walk because all the elevators were removed because I guess they were valuable. But working with her, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is my people. And so I think you quickly can find them if you're looking around and finding them. And she's not who she was, or she wasn't who she is now. Mm-hmm. I wasn't who I was. So part of it too is to recognize, you know, potential in the people around you and know that, okay, they're not there yet, but you feel the same track.
Yeah. And then it's like the, sort of like, because you don't know when like, or anything is going to happen and sort of like maintaining those connect. Well, the other thing is too, is like voicing that you're interested in working with them again. Cause I think it's like this, like, but then there's the line of like being too eager. So what do you feel is like a good way to,
I mean, you have to make that connection And the point is, when do you push and when do you let it happen? And I think, you know, enough can't be said for reading the room, right? And so some people can't, and you do push people away if you're too pushy and, but, you know, usually the people that you're trying to get in with and that you enjoy being around are busy people. So sometimes they do need, you know, an updated email and you know, a check-in. So I think, of course, you have to do that because it is a business. And so, you know, I do think there's follow-ups and you can't take it personally if they don't get back in time. The movie that's coming out that I produced with Jay Duplass, that is The Baltimoreans, which is coming out in September. But it, the lead actor, Michael Strassner, reached out to Jay, just blind DM'd him because they had a mutual contact. And he did it under the guise of, hey, I'm working on a short and I'm thinking of casting someone you worked with. So, you know, so it's not just, hey, big fan, you know, but it's like, hey, I'm doing my own thing. I'm establishing, you know, that. And then Jay didn't check his DMs for 6 months, you know, because these are busy, busy people. Yeah. And then went back and said, oh my gosh, thanks for reaching out. This person's great. Did you already make your short? And he's like, well, I'm thinking of a movie. And Jay's like, great. Tell me all about it. And then they ended up collaborating and making this movie together. I think it's not only persistence, but it's making sure there's a personal connection. Like not only going to the person and saying, hey, you're awesome, I want to work with you, but it's also, here's what I contribute. Like we're the, you know, I run a set that's a vibe that she likes. And so, you know, you want to be able to let them know that whatever risk they're going to take on you, because they will have to take a risk,
right,
is going to pay off and it's going to make them hopefully better as well.
Right. Yeah. I think people don't understand, like when you, someone doesn't know you, they're scared to death to hire you. Cause like you could fuck up.
Yeah. And so yes, you want to perform well. Like I say, like your every day on set is an audition. And so if you perform well and then you have the chance, you know, at the wrap party or whatever, even a simple, I would really love to work with you again, goes so far, because even if it's three projects for them or four projects down the line, they're going to be in a pickle and they're going to need someone and you're there. And then they're like, okay, well, I got to throw you in the mix because no one, everyone's booked, or we're doing this reshoot and I have to do it tomorrow. And then boom, you're there. It's like acting and auditioning. Like you can't get down if you don't get this part, you know, like you just have to keep the relationships going. And then that's what breeds into.
Yeah. And so, yeah, as an AD, you're organized. I would imagine very organized. And you said you also like doing some of the office work, making sure that day's organized. So, I mean, that is a thing that a lot of creatives struggle with. So what, if your AD mastery, like what secrets do you have for creatives in terms of keeping their shit together?
Well, I think part of it is like, I hate the paperwork and I will never be a UPM because I don't want to deal with money. I don't want to negotiate with rates and I don't want, you know, like, so it's a clear preference of, it's, you know, it's not only a skill set, it's whatever, but like ADing I've found is, you know, when I kind of cut my teeth, it was under a screamer. And, you know, who ran a set where everyone, where is this? What is it going to do? You know, and everyone is just tense and ready. And we made our days, but it was miserable. Yep. Like, you know, and so I think we're getting away from that now. But there was the discovery of actually, if people are loose and laughing and having a good time, then they're actually more efficient. And if they have ownership in the project, you know, you're not dictating everything, then they're going to work harder because now it's their set and they want it, you know, to look better. But as far as organization, I think the realization is just every set, whether it's like a student short film or it's a Marvel movie, it's the same stuff. There's just more of it, the bigger budget you have. So, you know, I always tell people, it's like you walk into any location, great. Where's your bathrooms? Where's your parking? Mm-hmm. How are people being fed? And where can people safely change? Mm-hmm. Great. You got that and you got a movie. And so then it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, great. Now, you know, how's equipment going to get there? And how's the da-da-da-da-da? But if you can just think of those three basic things, then you can start to sort of get out of the way and be creative. And what I do with all my directors is, especially on the indie level, is shot list. Even if you don't want to, or even if they're like, but we're going to find it on the day. I need to see my actors and I need to blah, blah, blah. It's like, great. That's fine because it does happen. But let's just lock something in, because then for the AD, what it's, is instantly I know, okay, great, this is going to take a lot of time, or it's not going to take a lot of time. Right. I mean, I've done a movie with no shot list where the director just refuses, and then I would just do one to guesstimate, because, you know, I think as a director, if you can learn, like, it's a visual language, so if you can learn to communicate visually, then it just makes you better. Because now other people can understand your vision, as opposed to you're sort of locked into your own vision and people are trying to guess, and it's frustrating and it takes a little more time, you know?
Right, right. And like every second, I forgot who said it, like you almost could hear it coming from the camera, the money being flushed every second it goes. You're just like, ah, no, I feel that so hard. Like I did a short film, the first one I was a lead producer on last June. And I was like, the director was like, oh, we'll just leave this decision to the day. I was like, no, every decision we can possibly make.
Yes.
Because then we can, like, no one likes when the day runs long. Like,
no.
Ever.
And also, if the day runs long, the producer's coming to you, well, you're going to cut this. And then now your vision is in someone else's hands, where if you can prep, then your vision is in your own hand. Because I'm like, we're either going to cut it now and prep, or you're going to cut it on the day and you're going to be really frustrated because we're missing this beautiful, you know, shot.
Right. And if you could have saved like 30 minutes, maybe you could have got it in from prepping, you know, and you could have just...
100%, always. And so I agree that, you know, that's a huge thing, you know, for director skill is to communicate visually, but also just... Even if you throw it out, just the process of, all right, if the actor does this, then I think this would be nice. Or all I know is they have to be standing and, you know, yada, yada, yada. All of that stuff only helps. And in fact is vital, because while it is a beautiful creative medium, it, you know, it's business. Film business, you know, show business. Yeah. So you gotta deliver on what you've promised, you know. Right.
For sure. And I also feel you on buy-in. Like when we did the film, I was like, I just hate being in a place where like people aren't like super obsessed with what we're doing. So I made everyone read the script from the PA to everyone. Like, you have to read the script and I am giving you the out. Like, no hard feelings. You can just put peace out. Because a lot of times I was like, oh my God, people show up not reading the script. Like, what? So that made a huge difference to people, like being there and being motivated to like do a great job. How have you gotten buy-in or encouraged buy-in to a project?
Well, I mean, you know, what do they say? Directing is 50% casting. I think it's the same way with crew. And so like the Duplass, which a lot of people have, but Duplass' motto is, you know, no assholes. So it's like whether that's a cast member or whether that's a, you know, this amazing cinematographer, but no, like life is too short. And so there's something about putting together a crew that wants to be there. That, and maybe they're not the number one, they're the number four, the number five, but they're great and they want to be there and they're going to work just a little bit harder. The set will then move, you know, more efficiently, faster. They're going to help people out instead of being curmudgeon-y, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's something about that. Also, you know, there's safety meetings every morning, but I try to, you know, make sure everyone's in that and we do go through the day and what we're shooting. So even if people haven't read it, this is what's happening and this is what to be thinking about. And so all of that stuff I think is really important because people are like, again, it's collaborative. Like it's not, as much as directors want to be a dictator or a producer wants to be the overseer, without the on-set props, you're screwed. And, and without hair makeup following their continuity, your day's done. And so you have to delegate and you have to be surrounded by people that you love and you trust and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, the vibes are off. It's just like, ugh, like it just doesn't
Yeah, it's a job. It quickly becomes a 14-hour day job, which is, you know, no one wants to do that.
Right.
Like that's
for sure.
That's insane. But if it's a project that you love, that at the end of the day in the theater you forget how freezing it was, then that, you know, that's a good motivator.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. For sure. Yeah. I will never like but I also create, I'm a stand-up as well. And so doing different shows and like, if I get hiring power, I will never book it. I just don't care. People are like, your shows are so positive and uplifting. I'm like, because I don't book assholes. It's really simple. Like, they just won't come to the door. So you said that, like, you think like that yelly kind of style is we're moving out of that, but I mean, we're backsliding on so many things in the world. Like, do you feel like we're going back in that direction at all?
Well, I mean, Who knows? But I do know that it's not efficient and it's not, I think it just took us time to realize it's just not efficient.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, you know, but the only way you can not be a yeller is if you're a great communicator and you're organized. Mm-hmm. Because part of what the yelling does is it covers up you forgetting to tell people what was next. And so suddenly you're like, oh, no, we're turning around. You know, as opposed to, hey, we're going to turn around two things from now. You better move everything. And this is exactly what we're going to see. But of course, you don't know if this is exactly what you're going to see if you didn't prep and if the director doesn't know. So there's all of this back-ended stuff that then allows you to be the good cop. But yeah, I would hope not. I know on giant projects it's hard not to but at the end of the day I don't know, at least in the world that I'm in, that's an old relic nobody wants. The chain smoking, you know, hard drinking, hard living, you know, miserable, looks 70 at 40, you know, that person.
That's great. That we love that. And boo to the mean people. Moon to the mean people.
Okay. There it is.
There it is. So, you've worked on a ton of projects. What are things that you wish like you could tell an actor, for say? Like, what are things that you wouldn't want, like would love them to know that you can't necessarily tell them in the moment?
As far as how to improve performance, or just stuff that I like, or
all of the above. I think it's like, I mean, we could say like the negative way. What are ways that they fuck up? You wish they wouldn't, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, if you only knew.
Well, I think what's really interesting is as an assistant director, you quickly discover that every director is different. There's some that have like an art background and they're very arty and they're very design based and visual based. There's some that are actors turned directors. So they're very actor process. Some are camera. And so they're technical and, you know, and really everyone's a little bit of everything, but you quickly realize, okay, wow, everyone is different. Every cinematographer is different and has a different way. And especially every actor is different. So even if you have an ensemble and a company, you know, there's the different processes. So I think on my end, I think it's important to learn their process quickly. And so I think if you can communicate your process, which is at a rehearsal, I just want to give 10%. And then if I could have a spot where I can be alone, you know, anything like that helps production because your AD is your best friend, you know, because mm-hmm. they're going to help you out. They're going to make you look good. They're going to cover for you if, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. And if it's antagonistic and they're crimping your style because you're trying to get in the moment, you know, then it's just not fun for anybody and it becomes really tough. So I would say approach your craft knowing that it's okay to say this is my craft and this is how I, you know, these are certain things that I need. You know, barring this is how I want the sushi served and this is yeah, how yeah. I'm like, yeah. you know, that yeah. sort of thing. But and also the knowledge of it's an ensemble, not only with your fellow actors, but with your crew and your performance. You have an operator, camera operator, but then you have someone who's focusing every, and oftentimes on a close-up, every tiny little, you know,
yep.
thing that you do is a dance with them. You have a boom operator who's mm-hmm. trying to not cast a shadow, but is following you around. So, you know, really strong actors I've seen go, okay, on this one, I think I'm going to move around a little more, or I'm going to just sort of like a calm aside. So the focus knows, so that boom knows. And then that way they're dancing with you. Whereas, you know, and 9 times out of 10, great, 99 out of 100, great camera operators, great first ACs who are the focus pullers, great boom will go, you just do you and we'll follow you. But anything that you can collaborate with is always, you know, gold.
Yeah. That's great to know. Yeah.
And then you look great yeah. on camera because they're focused and, you know, well-framed.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's like, cause you could have that take, you're like, oh, that's amazing. And then they didn't catch it. So.
Right. Cause you added something now, but if you're, and, but also you're like, it's okay to voice, hey, I'm going to be in the moment. I'm not sure where yeah. I'm going to go. So just so you know, and then yeah. that way they at least are ready, you know, cause right. you know, it's more documentary style, but if you rehearse it one way and then you decide to then, you know, change it, then
right.
you're right. You might lose that take.
Yeah.
So yeah, little stuff like that it is, you're part of a company, you're part of an ensemble that is both technical and creative, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. What if someone said like, being an actor is like being able to cry with 100 people not paying attention. Like we're sort of like just doing their own, you know, departments and you got to like have
or worse.
The moment.
Yeah. Like there's people across the street watching. There's, you know, like it is such demands, such a focus, you know, there's the classic Christian Bale, you know, meltdown or, you know, that sort of stuff. But he was completely justified because the cinematographer was right working and he was thinking of the next thing. So he's moving. There's probably a shadow he didn't like. So he's like, yeah. duh, 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 duh. And it's just, it's not fair because Christian Bale's not on set when he's lighting. So, you know, so, right. so I like to do that too, to sort of say, okay, actors get a rehearsal. We're all going to shut up. We're all not going to work. They're going to focus. They're going to talk. Then they're going to leave. It's our set.
Yeah.
They're not going to get in the way and yes. you can do whatever you want. But boy, the second they come back to set, we're clear. We can make little tweaks, but it's not our set anymore. And so you have to be really diligent about that because some actors are fantastic, you know, and,
right,
and
right.
are just so focused. But, you know, it's tough. And then to get back in the zone after someone makes a joke and starts laughing, even if it's over there or, right, you know, all that stuff. So it's really tough.
Right. Especially as like performers, like you want
right.
to entertain everyone. And then if you,
oh, yes. Yeah. And some yeah. are like, you know, some are, you know, even to crew, they're like, I'm sorry, I'm going to be rude, but I'm just going to be, you know, quiet or whatever, but it's not like personal, you know, cause they, yeah. they want to be cool, but they're just like, I'm going to be in the zone. And so often they'll just tell the AD or somebody just like, they're going to be in the zone for this. And then that way that yeah. information can be disseminated. So someone doesn't come up and, you
right,
know,
right.
make the daily joke or something yeah. while you're in the zone.
For sure. For sure. What do you think directors or producers should know, like from the stuff you've seen? I mean, you work with very talented people, but
yes,
I guess maybe it doesn't have to necessarily be, or in general, like, what have you learned from them that you think other people should know?
It's the equally, being overly prepared and then I guess there's no way to make something good if you don't know what you want. So I think there's something about that. Like lots of people will talk about they're on a TV set or they're on a movie and we call it coverage, but it's just, you know, if we're having a conversation, you got to look at this yep. person who's talking, this person who's talking, and then the waiter who comes to the table. Right. So what they'll often do is go, okay, great. We'll do three different sizes on this person. We'll do the same thing. We'll do the waiter. We'll do a wide. We'll do like mm-hmm. a long shot. So then in the editing room, we can see what works best. And mm-hmm. if you have a ton of angles, then you have more to work with and more to maybe make it longer, make it shorter. And oftentimes what happens in TV is they'll do that because they're not quite sure what the scene is, or they're not quite sure what they want to do. And then it just buys them, you know, mm-hmm. that flexibility.
Yeah.
And so sometimes what happens is you just get used to doing that and you don't have to know whose point of view is this scene
yeah.
and what's the emotional turning point or what's whatever. They're like, no, right. let's just get it down. And then let's move on. But I think there's something about, you know, if you want it to be good and not just boilerplate, which we all know what that is, then you need to know what you need and what you don't need. I worked with a director, Lynn Shelton, who, you know, was mm-hmm. kind of that Seattle
Yeah, I interviewed her for an article on Curve magazine.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. Yes. So she's incredible. So she came from being an editor.
Yep.
And so she was very judicious on what she needed and didn't need. And so she moved quickly to the point that I was like, are you sure you don't want a wide? Because just to have it.
Yeah.
Because she was like, no, I've edited it in my head and I don't want it because, you know, I'll never come to it. And so. You know, there's that, which is like, to know what you want means you know what you don't need. And that's like beautiful filmmaking. Because then if you have it, great. But if you don't need it,
right.
why waste everybody's time? Why wear your actors out? Why, you know?
For sure. I mean, it goes with so many creative projects. People, like, if you sit down with someone, it's hard to know, like, what direction to go in. It, like, wastes a lot of time and energy. And my friend really wants to write to bring this children's book that she wrote to life. And I was like, the first thing you gotta know is, what do you want this thing to look like? Otherwise, how are you going to find the right illustrator if you can't even see it yourself?
Yeah. And I think the secret for me to that, cause it is so overwhelming. And so there's something about like, okay, well, you know what you don't want it to look like.
Mm-hmm.
So voice that. Okay. You know what your favorite books are. Do any of these fit into that? And usually
right.
it'll be I love the colors of this and the style of, you know, like
right.
that's the sweet spot, I think. But there's something about the nose first, sort right. of like, I can't decide what I want to eat. Okay, great. I know I don't want Chinese because
yes.
I had that yesterday. I know I don't. So there's some weird creative trick where if you can first cross off what's not going to work, it somehow opens and reveals the fewer options that do for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's easier to say, I guess, to just be like, no. And then when you say yes, you feel like, oh my God, this is it. Like it can really be
stuck.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's another thing is every creative field is a conversation. You're never locked in. And in fact, what you think it's going to be at the beginning of the movie or the beginning of the painting or the whatever, it's not going to be. So, you know, it's a great starting point, but don't commit to that. But then it's also freeing to go, well, I don't have it 100%. Great. That's kind of a good, cause it, you know, it'll come the more you keep refining.
Right.
But you have to keep refining, you know, like that's the problem is that's the process.
Right. Is continuing to do the grind until you get it to what you want it to.
Yeah. And then and that's the fun and that's the embrace and that's why not everyone does it. So that's the point is the end result is almost just evidence of the grind, you know?
It's so hard. The thing is I tell myself when I'm like, oh my God, it's just so hard. Like I know what the story is, but I just can't, or I know what this joke is. And it just like, but that's why not everyone does it. Because if it was easy, it'd just be something anyone could do.
And also there's people way funnier. There's people way better filmmakers, better writers who don't do the refining and they just don't want to do the work and they don't make it. And so what's funny is when people complain about, oh, there's so much mediocre art and TV and film, they're not wrong. But those are the people refining and beating down the doors and making the relationships and worming their way in because they're working hard. And often people with more talent are a little entitled and don't want to do the work because, of course, they're way better. But it's just not how the world works. And it's especially not how a creative medium works, you know. It's sort of like there's no way around the hell of, you know, writer's block and the hell of knocking on doors and, you know, all of that. I think Michael Keaton had a great interview where he was talking about being a struggling actor and he had to change his mindset because I think he hadn't gotten an audition in a year or something like that. Like, you know, which is and amazing to think about, you know, but he then suddenly turned it in his mind that auditioning is the job and I'm going to go on these auditions and that's the job and I'm going to do great. And then I may get it. I may not get it, but that's not the job. The job is the audition. And then if I get it, great. Cause then if I do good, I will get another audition. And so the second he moved to my mindset is not the star and the premiere and the red carpet. My job is the work. He's like, I was not depressed. I was ready. And I had more energy. So I do love that, that the end script might not be our job, you know, the 30 minute set, is a great end result and the laughs and the applause are fantastic, but really your job is finding the perfect rhythm of this one stupid joke that you know is going to get there, but isn't, and it's keeping you up at night, but that's the job. That's it. You know,
that's the thing.
And most people don't want that job.
Yeah. So yeah.
They want the stand and they want the laugh, but they don't want the, you know, the I'm going to crack the nut. Yeah.
Well, even like we were saying before about like preparing, like Seinfeld said, like the grind is like to write every day so that at night the perfect word comes. Because you have to go through that hour of like not knowing, of like really failing all the time.
And what I think, again, I think it fits right within because that is you're eliminating what doesn't work. Yeah. And unfortunately it sucks because, you know, you're like, it's not Sudoku. I don't know if there is a solution. You know, I don't know if there is a right word. I know that I don't love this word, but maybe it's the only option, but you got to keep grinding. And then often, often than not, it does reveal itself. Yeah. But I think your brain is having to go, nope.
Yep. Let's go through the grinder.
So yeah, exactly.
So when you worked on Marcel, the Shell with Shoes On, and Somebody Somewhere, like a live action animation and then a proper human only series, what's the difference between like when you're dealing with partly non things there shooting and like dealing with all the people who are present on the screen shooting?
Well, so completely different. Like the only thing that I think was similar is tone, which is both are about grief and they're about, you know, I think in both cases, I'll say what's similar first. In both cases, you have a known IP, you have this Marcel the Shell, which was a web short mm-hmm. that everybody loved and millions of views. And then you have Bridget Everett, who's this powerhouse mm-hmm. cabaret performer.
Yep.
And so if you think about, okay, great. I want you now to pitch something to Hollywood. Well, great. Marcel the Shell gets lost and it's a funny adventure as he's trying to find other people like him. And you can totally see it. And it's this fun, silly, but instead they're like, no, let's tackle grief and channel cathartically maybe some awful stuff from our own life. And that's the story we're going to choose to tell. Mm-hmm. For this funny little animated thing. Same with Bridget Everett. What could she do? Oh my gosh, a touring cabaret star and how hilarious that'll be. And she's a rock star and everyone loves her. And she's like, no, I want to pretend if I didn't make it and I had to go back to Manhattan, Kansas, a failure at, you know, in my 40s, in a very conservative family and community, what that would feel like and what my, basically all of my fears, let's make that. And same with Marcel, like that's every fear that they had that they channeled into that. And so what I love about both of those is that is so hard because I think to be sincere and not be schmaltzy and not be cynical, but just be accurate is so rare and like shockingly so, like to for us to be honest with ourselves and like with comedy, roasting, hilarious. It gets all the views. Right. It's hilarious, but that's a caricature. You know, you're making fun of a caricature of someone and you're reducing it to that. But to see someone and validate them and recognize them and make it funny and not be
a jerk.
Flattery yeah. and not be a jerk and not, yep. it's, yeah. And not, but also not be fake and false.
Yep.
It's such a, you know, sweet spot that to be able to do both of those back to back was like, you know, amazing. So that's what like I love about both of those because they had every reason to be the hit and go the easy route and do the fantasy version. And they're like, no, I want to do the human grounded version. And I think that's what will make them last longer and revisited mm-hmm. and rewatched.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, it felt like having known, like I've been on Bridget's shows and like known her, like, you know, tangentially, like, you know, the New York performing community. And like, it felt like so authentically her story, even though it was like, obviously so different. It was just, so, I mean, there were so many
but
times.
It's could not be more autobiographical from her sister to her mother to her, like it is so on that the second I got to know her a little more and, you know, in her show, she reveals stuff and stuff like that. Then you're like, oh yeah, no, this is almost who she is more than the cabaret star, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, sorry not to interrupt, but that's what I sort of love is, you know, is she chose of the two personas, she's like, no, I want to be the really vulnerable. She says it on set. She's like, you know, I'm not an actor, so I know the scene is tough or it's whatever, but I'm like, that's this incredible beauty is she chose the hard path mm-hmm. that she can't do in her sleep, you know, that she's vulnerable and worried about. And then, you know, but that's why it's better, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
That's why she's nominated for an Emmy. Yeah. So
yeah.
There you go.
And then that always
and won a Peabody.
Yeah. I mean, like what's beyond, below, like what's underneath all of the stuff she does. It feels very authentic to that. Like it's something like you're not surprised. Like I didn't feel like I was watching it being like, I didn't suspect that some of this was going on. You know, it felt like, oh, this is it.
Yeah. And then to make it funny. Like again, it's that really sweet spot because it is the definition of low stakes, you yeah. know? And so like, my friend's not meeting me for breakfast and that was our weekly thing. That kind of hurts my feelings. How do you make a show about, you know, like that and yet make it real? And then you realize, no, we all have those slights. Or, you know, mm-hmm. or, and it really does affect us and we're afraid to communicate about it because it's vulnerable. And so so somehow, you know, like to just be honest about those things
right.
and not have to make it funny or, yeah, go ahead.
And it was one of the few shows I've seen, like where friendship is prioritized as a relationship that's real and like needs time and attention and can hurt you. And that was very satisfying to see all of those story arcs in it.
Yeah. Like the most recent where, you know, Joel even feels guilty for finding love because mm-hmm. it gives you less time for your bestie. And so that, and then Bridget's having to play hurt and mm-hmm. kind of a jerk, you know, which we've all been, and we've all been there. The ugly side of ourself of like, oh, I'm not getting the energy that I rely on.
Yeah.
It's sort of like when you stop taking serotonin or you know, and your body hasn't produced it in a while and you're like, oh, this sucks. I'm having withdrawn. So yeah, that anyway.
So let's talk about Baltimoreans. It's coming out in September.
Yes. I think 4th. I'll find out. But yeah, it's in theaters. But it's basically a kind of like Before Sunrise on Christmas Eve. Yeah, shot in Baltimore. We shot it in Christmas. It's the coldest I've ever been in my entire life. truly, I think the wind chill was like -10, -5 because we were on the water once. But it's basically two people that meet and just spend, you know, the next 12 hours or so, not even, you know, together. And so it's very, I talk about autobiographical. It's very, Michael Strassner, who wrote it, was an improv comedian and so it's sort of everything scary that happened in his life. He put into it. And so, and I think Jay kind of centered in that and is like, okay, let's, I know the hook of these two people that are going to spend a day together, but let's hang on it, all of this trauma you've been through, who you are. And so that even though it's funny, this character is so real. And then the character they created to kind of be opposite of him is lived in and real. And, it's so much fun. And then that's something where we planned, we did everything, but then, an actress showed up, who played his fiance and she's phenomenal. And so, which, you know, which is great. And so there was like one thing missing and in the script. And so, you know, we're already shooting, we're already whatever, but she's there and her, just her performance and seeing it gave them the revelation of, oh, there needs to be this is what's been missing. So they wrote a scene. We had to shoot it because she was only available a certain amount of days. And so we had to add it, but it's, I think, one of my favorite scenes in the movie. And it only came together because A, this wonderful actress's performance, and B, they had the wherewithal to say, we love the script. We've, you know, beaten it out over 3 years. It's my life. Yet, if we're just going to judge it as a script and as a collection of scenes, it's not, these two characters don't have what's needed. So let's have the wherewithal and the humility to go, cool, let's fix it. Even now, though yeah. Drew is sweating blood, and even though, you know, we're freaked out about money or whatever, it's like, no. The ending wins, you know, like whatever's best wins. And so they did it. And it's beautiful. So stuff like that is so much fun. But it's you know, we shot it in like 9 or 10 days and no budget, and let Baltimore be Baltimore. And you have a little more freedom when you do something like that.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah, I love like grounded comedy. Like, I love it's called Baltimore on. So like we know we're going to get stupid.
Yes.
But then we also get the underneath behind that.
Well, and that's the thing. It's very similar to Bridget, where it's like, she's a big personality. Michael's this huge personality, and he's, you know, so he's funny and he's great, but more often than not, you know, comedians are the most tortured people. Like, that's the whole reason they're comedians. And yep. So that's the, you perfected your defense mechanism. And so that's what's so beautiful, is it's like, cool, who are you when curtain closes? And, right. You know, or, you know, the night after a good show and all the adrenaline's gone, you know, who are you? And so that's what's so fun is, and, you know, well, there'll be a scene and he's on, but then there's the scene right after. And so to see that, and same with Bridget, like she's with her friends, everything's great.
Yep.
And then we see her sitting on the couch alone watching TV, you know, with nothing, because she doesn't have the external stimuli. Yeah. So I do love that. And especially when people can be that vulnerable, because we like to pretend, you know, like movies are fantasy and it's the idealized version of ourselves and everything. But at the end of the day, it's not, you know, it's not necessarily human, you know, you know, when it gets so far.
Right. Down for sure. There. For sure. It seems like a through line of the projects you work on are bringing like the humanity to these sometimes ridiculous situations.
I do think that's a great sweet spot. Like, did you see F1 by chance?
I didn't see it.
So that's Brad Pitt. It's basically Top Gun Formula One racing. But his character, you know, has the traumatic backstory, and he's now aged out, but there's one last shot. Let's do it. And so he shows up. He's the best driver on these new cars, you know, even though he's an old racer, these are new, fancy. And I thought, oh, that might be, no, he's great at it. He knows everything about the engineering. He designs the greatest car. Like, at no point is there any struggle, except that he has a flashback or something like that. And so as I was watching it, I just wanted one scene where he calls an ex because he's lonely and they don't hang up or they don't pick up, you know, or something where, he's perfect. And he looks like Brad Pitt. So it's like, so I'm watching this and I'm like, it's so gorgeously shot and the music is incredible. Like, everything is working, but I'm like, I don't care. I don't want to spend time on this.
Right. I feel you. That's probably why I've never watched it.
Yeah. I know. But I was so excited about it, but it's just not for me.
I love it. All right. We have a few questions we always ask people. Oh, yeah. And one of them is your misfit moment. The moment where you knew that the ordinary world was not for you.
Nice. I was born and raised in Kentucky. within the church and within, you know, conservative, you know, family. We had lunch after church together every single Sunday. And
somebody somewhere vibes.
Incredibly somebody somewhere vibes. And so, so yeah, that's up until, you know, even into college. And then I think there was a point where, cause like, even to this day, I'm like, golden rule, greatest, you know, to me, essence of human morality. That's great. Yeah. Like if we can do that, perfect. So that I loved and responded to. And then you get to a point where you're like, ah, this mindset comes with political ramifications and a societal structure and a, you know, point of view that is now in conflict with, you know, the essence of it. And so I think that was like college years where that was the crisis of, I want to believe the best in humanity. I want to fix it and I want to make it great. And now I'm in conflict with the organization that raised me and, you know, and because they're not behaving according to whatever those belief systems are, which I think any religion does that just because you can't have any collection of humans and have a singular belief system, you know, like it just doesn't work on a film set. It doesn't work. And so I think that was the thing where it's like, no, I think I creatively, emotionally, societally, you know, everything. I think the oddball is the more accurate of how the world works. Yeah. You know, I don't think the norm, I think the norm is us all pretending to, And so we all agree that, okay, yeah, this is cool and this keeps us in the society. So, you know, that's great. Right. But yeah, everyone who has an OCD house and family are not happy, I have found. Like, if there's not some mess and chaos that they embrace, you know, I don't think that's being human.
Right. There's something wrong. There's something wrong.
Because it's like, why are you hiding this from me? Why, you know, what is the secret if you can't live out loud and go, oh my God, my kids had a play date. Sorry. Ignore the da-da-da-da-da.
Yep.
If it's perfect, and then you're like, yeah, well then what's the dysfunction of me seeing who you are, you know, or how you dress or how you, you know, want to identify. Sure. It's so odd. Sure. Anyway.
The next question is, mispiration, if you will. In the low moments, what are the, what is something you might read or look at or listen to that get you up and going?
It's funny. Like, I love movies. I love, fiction. I love all that sort of stuff, but I tend to read nonfiction. And so my pick me up are essays by Oliver Sacks, the neural psychologist. But his whole thing is his obsession with brain, I would say disorder, but I don't, you know, I'm sure he would say neurological inspiration or, you know, something like that. But these very rare, to the point no other people can kind of figure it out. You know, a painter who's in a car wreck and lost his ability to process color. And so he only sees a grayscale world and how that impacts him. And they're just such a quick little read to revisit. And then it's just so inspiring to me because he writes it like as a memoir, even though it's a case study. And, and they're just, each of them are just so, because in all of them, they're human beings who have been given every excuse to just stop. And yet you find a way they exist. And so this one particular painter ended up being a night owl. And then because in night, it sort of becomes grayscale anyway. And so then he becomes social again and he starts painting in black and white. So it's just it's incredible. So every single one that he does is just such a lovely, you know, just reminder of, and they're also bizarre and strange, which I love too. You know, we love too, of just the potential, the human potential for just complete chaos is, you know, that's where our comedy is, and you know, our tragedy and all of
which
that.
Like,
you know,
humanity and all of this. Yeah.
Yes.
And
so to see that, you know, just like, you know, a complete bizarre, your body not doing what you need it to do, and yet finding a way to exist and even thrive is the greatest.
I love it. Cool. So we have a very quick question from my character, Carmela Rivoli. I usually have the wig and the glasses, but we're going to just go. We're going to go straight here.
That's right.
All right, Drew, so good to see you. I'm in from Boca Raton, Florida. I can't say I've never made it to the place in Kentucky. That's right. You're from. Is that right? Yeah. I got it. Okay. Okay.
Where the chicken, they got chicken and bourbon and horses, basically.
Exciting. I like chickens. The wings, you mean fried? I like them fried. That's where I can handle. But that's exciting. So listen, I love the thing, no assholes, because I've had it. I've had it with people, my adult community. They come in, they're such jerk offs. The thing is, when you find an asshole, other than, you know, my MO is just to say, go fuck yourself. But how do you handle it? Because you seem very nice. You're a very nice boy. So how do you handle assholes?
I avoid them. I think that's the main one. I know you maybe not, I don't know if you're in a community where you're kind of stuck. Yeah.
It's a little bit stuck.
Yeah. So, but yeah. And then if you can't avoid them, then it's always about commonality, right? Like you're like, okay, well, at least we both like X, Y, or Z. We can relate to that. And then we sort of don't.
Yes.
I have a neighbor right now who decided we share a patio, and he decided to camp out right next to my bedroom window. So I think you got me. I would probably want your advice on how to handle them.
I read this in a book, and it was a humor book, but it was a memoir of how she'd help with an asshole, but I think it can help you. Similar situation. She got a switch by her bed and then ran a cord to a spotlight that would go on the person outside their house that was making a lot of noise. So put a spotlight right on this asshole, real, like, you know, like a stage light, real hard on them, and they'll get right off the patio.
Genius.
There we go. We got it. We solved it here.
So that's the thing. Shine a light on them. That's the answer.
Shine a light in so many ways.
Yeah.
We got to do it. All right. I'll see you later, okay? I'm going to go back.
Good to see you. Yeah.
See you. All right, Drew, she likes you.
She's awesome. She literally is my aunt. So that's a lot of love there. So that's great.
Yes, yes. Yes, she's a part of every Misfit Variety show, and she comes on every podcast. She's a good time. So, all right. So, Drew, so where can people come find you, follow you, and follow Baltimoreans?
So Insta is just Mountain Drew Langer, because I used to be addicted to Mountain Dew, so that became Mountain Drew very quickly.
I thought you just hiked a lot.
I'm over that now. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I tell people now. I'm like, no, I'm a fit guy, but I'm from Kentucky, so that's the part that showed. But Baltimore on Street. Let me look it up. But it's in theaters, which is very exciting. I believe it's September 4th.
Great. This will go out like a little bit after then. People will be hearing this.
Yes.
And yeah. So we can.
And yeah. And it's just, you know, it's a tiny movie. IFC picked it up, but it's, you know, it's just, it's great. And so it's worth just going because I think more stories like this need to be told. Mm-hmm. But also I think it's, you know, it's a great movie. And I think indie right now, if it's horror, does well. But, you know, like personal stories, I think, you know, people maybe don't want to feel as much, but it's a good.
It's good for you.
Yes, it's good. Yeah. It's a fun story, and they're great people. So.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for stopping by, and I look forward to seeing the film.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
there we have it. You can follow Misfits Making It on my social pages at Lauren Logi on all the things, Instagram especially, and also X Twitter thing and Threads and TikTok and YouTube Shorts and all the things. You can get updates and inside info by joining my email list at www.laurenlogi.com. Thank you to Ani Makutsian for editing, Edward Sheila at Radio Misfits Podcast Network. Thank you to Maureen Asiant for our new music and Maddie McLennan for making the podcast. And thanks to our listeners for bringing us back for another season. We'll see you soon.
The preceding was a presentation of the Radio Misfits Podcast Network. Find our other great shows on iTunes,
Stitcher Radio,
and at RadioMisfits.com. Thank you.